Populist. And hey, this is episode 21, the season 2 premiere. It's great to be back with you all. And with me, as always, is Kirk Trittner, the Angie to my honky-tonk woman. How you doing there, Kirk?
Wow, I feel I should be wearing a lot more makeup and getting my stilettos out.
Well, you are a bitch. See what I did there?
You can't always get what you want, Steve. Hey, everybody. Welcome, as Steve said, to season 2, episode 1, episode 21 overall. And we're going to bookend the season finale of season 1, which was top 10 Beatles songs. And this episode is going to be top 10 Rolling Stones songs, hence all the hints that you just got and the playful banter that Steve and I had. Again, like the Beatles episode, this one was tough. You got 50 years worth of recordings by the Rolling Stones to go through. I mean, there's a lot to sift through to get to that top 10. What, did you have any problems or did you have a direction right away?
Yeah, a lot of stuff to go through for sure. Trying to think of how am I going to vote about this, you know, what's my criteria going to be was tough also. And so I think it ultimately comes down to, you know, actual, the musical quality of it, the lyrics, the meaning of the song at the time, I think was big, along with, you know, whether it was a hit or not, but if it achieved top five status, that wasn't as important for me. What about you?
You know, I kind of radiated out from Mick and Keith. I mean, from the Glimmer Twins. You know, almost every one of my songs or any of the songs we could have chosen has a Keith hook somewhere along the line. When Mick and Keith are working their best, you know, Keith usually had the hook and the chorus and Mick had the verses. When it comes together, and, you know, put it in the melting pot and you know, throw in a little Charlie Watts, throw in a little Bill Wyman and, you know, Ron Wood in later years. Brian Jones in the earlier years, you came up with some really interesting songs. That's something else I looked at too in choosing tracks is, you know, interesting songs, songs that have stood the test of time. Cause you know, as we talked about, beforehand, you and I, you know, we're not young, we're not old, but we're not young, but we've never known a popular culture without the Rolling Stones. Mm-hmm. It's so hard to believe that they were contemporaries of the Beatles, who we all said goodbye to 50 years ago. From performing, I think they stopped in 70 or 71. So that's 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. Yet the Stones are still going and they're still relevant. I still think they can lay claim to, you know, what they've called themselves for years, which is the world's greatest rock and roll band.
Yeah. There's you'd be an idiot not to have them in the argument, whether you settle on them or not. But as I think we're saying, since we did best Beatles songs to wrap up season one, we're doing best Stone songs. I think we obviously think that these are the two best bands around, as we also showed in our greatest rock bands list.
Absolutely. So I'm interested to hear your list. I looked over mine and I said, you know what? I think we're going to match, but I don't think we're going to match overall. I'm setting the over under on duplicate songs, not duplicate positions, but duplicate songs. I'm going to put the over under at 6.5.
I'll take the over on that one.
Ooh,
I
will take the over.
Oh God, now that I say that, I'm questioning myself. No, I'm going to stick with, I'm going to stick with the over. You always find something, even as well as I know you, you always come up with something that is a particular Kirk slant on it. Good, but I'm just not what I'm anticipating. And, I don't know. I think we're going to match more on this one. I don't know. I'm going to say, over.
You're going to go over. Okay. What about exact matches? The same song in the same chart position.
God, no.
I'm going to put the over under at 1.5.
God, because we saw. I know. All right. I'll go over there also. I'll take that over too.
Ooh. So you're saying that we think alike. Is that what you're saying?
You really,
is that we think alike?
I think
alike?
You set that exactly right. I don't think there's going to be. I don't think it's going to be much over. I think if it is, it's going to be just like two. All right. We'll see.
All right.
All right. Well, so much to go through, so many songs to decipher, which means that obviously we couldn't use all of the songs. What are the songs that are going to make it to this unlisted segment for this week for you? Which are three songs that we will not see on your list?
Well, I'm going to save the really close ones for our second unlisted at the end of the show.
Okay.
But as my 20 to 15 range, you're going to find that on my list, you will not hear the titles Happy, It's Only Rock and Roll, or As Tears Go By.
Interesting. For me, you will not hear Ruby Tuesday or Midnight Rambler or Beast of Burden, which is actually one of my favorite Stone songs, but it's not going to be on there.
Yeah. And as a reminder, these are not our favorites. These are the songs that we think are objectively the best Stone songs.
Yes. Yes. And I apologize for stumbling over my words. I hopefully won't do that. This is kind of a new one for us. This is a late night populist version. As some of you may or may not know, we had a few gremlins in the system, and we actually recorded or tried to record the other day, and it didn't turn out very well audio wise. At least on my end, especially, the quality was really bad. So we're here trying for you. This is a take two of a very special episode, but you know what? We wanted to get it right. So let's get into things, shall we?
Let's do it.
You went first at the beginning of last season. And if memory serves, I think you went first in the last episode of last season also. So I should probably go first on this one.
I think so.
All right.
So Steve Hafer, what is your number 10 Rolling Stones top 10 song?
Number 10.
My number 10 is, it's a great song. I didn't love it when I was young, but it's one of those Stone songs that just keeps growing and growing and growing and growing on me. And I don't know what took me so long, because it's a great song. And that is the song Wild Horses from the 1971 album Sticky Fingers. It only hit number 28 on the charts, so it's not one of their big, big popular ones, but I think it is a popular song in itself. It's a bit of a sleeper because it is a little slower, and it's kind of a huge departure from their norm. But like I said, as the years go by, I think its legacy grows as well. It's heartbreaking and it's laid back. The lyrics of Jagger describe like the long lost life of a rock star and their vulnerabilities. And some people say that it might have some of Jagger's pain from the breakup that he had with Marianne Faithfull. Keith's chorus that he wrote was a tribute to his infant son, Marlon, and just about him missing him when he was on the road and wanting to be with his son. Richard said this song, Wild Horses, was the classic way that he and Mick worked together, as far as Keith coming up with the guitar licks and the chorus, and then Mick getting all involved and losing himself in the lyrics. It's really a classic way that they did. He said Wild Horses was about the usual thing of not wanting to be on the road, but being, you know, a million miles from where you really want to be. It was one of the songs that was recorded at Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Jagger and Richards reveal a lot about themselves during this session, in the song and the music, and in the fact that they were sharing a bottle of bourbon as they were passing it back and forth while they were sharing a mic as well. So it's a cool song. It's my number 10, Wild Horses.
Well, you've already got one towards the over on our little side bet, because I've got Wild Horses on my list too, but I'm going to talk about it a little bit further up the list.
Oh, I thought you were going to have number 10 right away. Okay. All right. But there's one match. That's good.
You got one.
So let's talk about what is your number 10 if Wild Horses is not it.
Well, yeah, you kind of went for the soft and delicate Rolling Stones to start your list. And I'm jumping right in with what is just a straight forward rock and roll song. It's also from the album Sticky Fingers, released in 1971. The song is Bitch.
Nice.
It's the classic Keith riff. It's horns. It's that vintage early fabled Stone sound. They use brass on this song, which is the first time
they
use brass on any album, let alone any song. And it gave it that Memphis horns feel. I think they got a little bit of that, a taste of some of that when they were in Muscle Shoals, and just got that kind of horns feel, and they thought it would be a good place to use the horns on this song. It's not about a specific woman. It's rather about how love is a bitch. And like I say, Keith was the one that said it's straightforward rock and roll, the kind of stuff that we love. It was Charlie Watts, meat and potatoes. You know, I wanted to give a call out to the late, great Charlie Watts early in my list.
Charlie, we love you.
And this is one of those songs that not only do you want to play air guitar, you want to play air saxophone, because it's just got that great chorus that you want to sing along with, play along with. So number 10 for me is from Sticky Fingers. The song is Bitch.
I'm almost the same shame to say it's not on my list. And I do love that song, and everything you said is exactly right. What is it about rock bands that use horn sections well? I mean, Tower of Power, Chicago, Aerosmith on a couple songs. It's just when it's done well, it's so cool. It's so neat. I love it. Great song.
Love horns and rock and roll. It's a match made in heaven.
Absolutely. Good pick. All right. We're off to a good start. Let's move on.
Number nine.
My number nine is a song that I was trying for some reason, and I don't know why, because I love it, was trying to justify that why it shouldn't be on the list. And I said, you know what? It absolutely should be on this list. And that is the 1969 song Honky Tonk Women. It was a number one hit, but overall for the year 1969, it finished at number four. So it was quite powerful, quite popular. It ended up on the Rolling Stones magazine's top 500 list at slot number 116. I think it's one of the hippest, coolest songs of the Stones. It's timeless, and it's great on stage. It was released the day after the group founder, Brian Jones's death, as a single, as I mentioned. And one of the songs on the flip side of that 45, the B-side, was You Can't Always Get What You Want. So talk about a nice 45. Wish I had that original. Keith Richards described the sacred place that Honky Tonk Women has in the concert set list, that he always said, if they weren't dancing by the time that song came on, you knew they weren't getting it on. In the 1989 Steel Wheels tour, they debuted two 60-foot-tall inflatable women that were cued to blow up and appear, and they bobbed to the music just as you got to the first chorus. Keith also said, it's one of those tracks that you just knew was a number one hit before you even finished that MF-er. He knew it. The band loved it. The crowd loves it. I love it. Great song, Honky Tonk Women.
It is a great song, and you've already stolen one of my second unlisteds. It was just out of my top 10. But, you know, we talked a little bit about Charlie Watts in my prior pick. Man, the unique rhythm he laid down for Honky Tonk Women, if you just kind of listen to the track in your mind, and it's just that really unique beat. It doesn't steal the show, but it's a really interesting beat, and I think it helps make the song really interesting as well.
Yeah.
I do like the song a lot. It's not in my top 10, but it's still a great choice.
It just makes you move and groove when you hear it. It's fun. What is your number nine?
My number nine is also off of Sticky Fingers. And this may be one of those tracks that you were talking about that isn't exactly Stone's mainstream. But I just think it is just such a perfect Rolling Stones song. It's called Can't You Hear Me Knockin'? It's an unusually long track. It's 7:14, 7:15. I want to say the meat and potatoes of the song is only about 3 minutes long. I mean, Mick is done singing by the 2:45 mark.
Yeah.
But they just jam for another 5 minutes. Mick Taylor, who had just joined the band at the time, is quoted as saying, towards the end of the song, I just wanted to keep playing. Everybody was putting their instruments down, but the tape was still rolling. It sounded good. So everybody quickly picked their instruments back up and kept playing. It was a one take song. Again, great hook right at the top. Keith's got a 23-second lead in with that killer opening riff. It's got a little bit of a Santana influence with the jam at the end. And I think that's kind of cool because Santana actually covered the song in 2010. And one website where I was doing my research quoted this. And I forgive me if I don't remember, but they said, this is where the Rolling Stones, especially during their live shows, we're practically announcing to the audience, we are here to steal your daughters. It's Babe Ruth calling his shot. They were just saying, we are the best rock and roll band in the world, and this is us. It's a great hook. It's a great vocal. It's a great jam. You know, hold my beer. We are the best. And I also found it interesting, too, that Billy Preston contributed keyboards to this song. So does that make him the fifth Beatle and the sixth Stone?
It makes him a god. That's what it makes him. Come on.
Yeah. Talk about Zelig. This guy was everywhere in the late 60s, early 70s.
Don't take away his own stuff. But I mean, you could and just still say career. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's the song right there.
That old joke Dennis Miller used to have where he'd say that guy used to be in, you know, that actor used to work in so many things. He's in your home movies.
Yeah.
You know? That was Billy Preston back then.
Can't You Hear Me Knocking? That's one of those that I did not anticipate from you. Interesting choice.
Great tune.
Moving on.
Number eight.
My number eight is a song that everybody knows. I think most everybody loves to some degree. Stones fans love it. It was a number one, but it's only a number eight for me. And that is the song Brown Sugar from Sticky Fingers, 1971. It's the first song on my list of what I call, that contains what I call the Keith Richards trio. And that's those three dullable, memorable guitar licks of his. He's had so much more, but three that just really say the Rolling Stones. And I'll talk about the other two later. They're also on my list. He got help for this one by the famous Ry Cooder when he was developing this riff. But this is one of those songs that is really reputation making for both Keith as a guitarist and the band also. It's another song that was done in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. And it's funny that they did it down in the Bible Belt in the South, and where the song deals with slavery, interracial marriage. And of course, brown sugar is a moniker for slang for a type of heroin. So that was pretty bold of them. But if you wanted to know the definition of a rebellious band, I guess that's a good way to reinforce it. And that's what the Stones were after for sure. They recorded this song in two takes. So they're not quite as good as Can't You Hear Me Knocking, but they did in two takes. And they really got what Jagger was after. They wanted it to sound dirty, and it is very dirty in all of its glory. The song debuted live at the infamous Altamont concert that the Stones are infamous for. It's just one of the nastiest songs around of theirs, but it's great, and it's one of the biggies, Brown Sugar.
We have found another song that just didn't make my list.
Really?
It's a great tune. It kicks off Sticky Fingers really, really well. But during the course of my research, I found a quote from Mick. And that was, God knows what I'm on about in writing that song. It's such a mishmash. I wrote it in 45 minutes. All the nasty subjects in one go. I would never write that song now. And as soon as I read that, I kind of went, okay, well, Mick's not that high on it. God forbid he hears this podcast and thinks that I'm a dope for choosing it.
I'm not going to argue with Mick, because that is why it's a little farther down on my list. Because I think because of some of that hollowness in the song itself, as far as there are other songs that are so much more rich and deep, and they carry the thought out better than it does. But anyway, hey, did you bring a number eight choice with you?
Get off of my cloud. My number eight was your number 10. And this is the third song in a row from Sticky Fingers. It is Wild Horses.
Okay.
Agree with all the things you had said before, how Mick and Keith worked together on this. Although it is kind of odd that Keith started the song as his plank to leaving Marlon, his young newborn son, going out on the road, and Mick kind of hijacked it to make it about his relationship, breaking up with Marianne Faithfull as well. I mean, ultimately, you don't think love song when you think Rolling Stones, but I would say, with all due respect to songs like Angie or Lady Jane, this is the best love song that the Rolling Stones ever recorded. It was highly influenced by country artist Gram Parsons, he of the Flying Burrito Brothers. He and Keith were hanging out a lot at this point in time, and this is kind of a little bit of the Bakersfield influence being brought into the Stones. Another great guitar part by Keith. It's just acoustic rather than the electric, you know, powerful kind of stuff we're used to hearing. I just love this song. I mean, it was recorded in 69, wasn't released until 71 because of contractual difficulties. Lots of challenges on the song, not only, you know, the songwriting back and forth. The band's normal piano player bowed out of the session to record this because he didn't like playing minor chords.
Yeah.
So they had to find somebody else to come in to play the keyboards, you know, for it as well. But it just shows how the Stones were smart enough to be tastefully restrained when they needed to be. You can't help but fall into this song. I love Wild Horses, and it is my number eight.
He won't play minor chords. It's like the roadie speech from Wayne's World, picking out the Brown M&Ms or whatever. Ozzy for Ozzy Osbourne. That was it. Yeah. All right. Well, I see we agree on that one to be on our list. That's good. Let's move on.
Number seven.
My number seven is by far the lowest ranked song as far as the Billboard Top 100 or anything. And that was the song from Beggar's Banquet, the album of 1968. And it's Street Fighting Man. It peaked at 48. That's all, just 48. Ah, but why? There's a reason. I'll get to that in 1 second. It's known as one of Jagger and Richards' most politically inclined works. It deals with the protests that were going on in a little bit in the UK, but mostly in Paris and the United States at the time, and the police responses to them. A lot of them had to do with Vietnam, but there were other political and social issues as well. Mick saw a protest in the UK, and he just, you know, it was nice, but he didn't see enough of it. And he saw everything that was going on in the States and in Paris and thought Londoners, the kids, should be doing more. A lot of the song was recorded in the bedroom of one of the hotel rooms on Keith's cassette recorder. Charlie Watts had an almost toy jazz set. Brian Jones had a zitar. Keith had an acoustic guitar and a bass, or an electric bass. And they would play onto the cassette. And Keith would just move them around to different points of the room, closer or nearer the cassette, as his way of mixing. So the result was a mono track on for the single. It was a very distorted sound, which is what he was after. It was just perfect. So the call for resistance and violence protests created, that's the call within the song, it created a big backlash by the radio stations, and a lot of them refused to play it, hence the number 48 ranking. It was subversive. It did call out sleepy London town and its teenagers, while at the same time philosophizing that it may not make a difference to protest. It just may not matter. So still, at the end of the day, Street Fighting Man is at the core of the Stones canon, and it's very deserving to be on this list, I think.
I think you're absolutely right, and I will add to some of those stories in just a minute when I talk about it a little bit higher on my list.
Ooh. So that's another match.
Another match. All right. Not an exact match. Good. We haven't had one of those yet.
Nope. But I take it you're not talking about it now, so what will you be talking about now?
At my number seven, we're going to finally get off of the Sticky Fingers album.
Oh, thank God.
And check into 1972's Exile on Main Street. The song is Tumbling Dice. This song has such a great groove. There is no way you can't sing along to this. It's that mid-tempo, you know, Charlie driving it, Bill Wyman on the bass, just laying down that wonderful rhythm track. It's a messy mix, but I got to tell you, that's when I love the Stones. The less produced they sound and the more like they just set up in the studio and they're playing and they're having fun, that's when I really love the Stones. And this song epitomizes that to me. It was a messy mix, but it gave it that unproduced organic feel, a lot of background vocals on it. Mick actually played guitar on this track, not predominantly, but you know, he very rarely played instruments on a lot of these tracks. So this is a rarity for that as well. Exile on Main Street was a double album released in 72, and it was victim of poor sales, like you just talked about for Street Fighting Man, and harsh criticism when it came out. But I think over the years, the album has become more appreciated and is now considered, you know, some of the Stones' best work. And I would argue it is the best soul tune that Mick and Keith ever wrote and the Stones performed. Loved Linda Ronstadt's cover of it in the mid-70s. Yeah. Number seven for me is Tumbling Dice.
Interesting. Best soul tune. Interesting. Interesting. I like how you said about that you love them the most when they're just kind of down, dirty, simple, just having fun and everything. And that is, they're great at that. And a lot of bands, you get crucified for doing that. But some bands, these guys, there's a couple others that come to mind, Skynyrd, you know, that get away with it and got away with it very well. But the Stones excel at it. However, I think as much as I love that, I love their complicated things even more. And I'll get to a couple of examples of those later on. But I think they do both things so well. That's why I love them. They're the Stones, man.
I don't disagree. But I mean, if you think about it, you know, you and I have both had the good fortune of seeing the Stones at one point in time or another over the last 30 years.
Yes, we.
I saw them with Guns N' Roses at the Coliseum in the 80s.
I sat right next to
them. I want to say I've seen them one more time since then. You've seen them before. That's right. We did go together.
Yeah.
What would you give, though, to have seen the Stones in the Universal Amphitheater or at the Palomino in a small club? I mean, how cool would that have been?
Or the Troubadour in San Francisco. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I just think they would have been such a great band to see in that small, small venue. And don't get me wrong. I like the more complex produced stuff as well. I mean, you know, Wild Horses, you know, was a song like that. But I think that they're at their best when they're really just sitting down and just playing and being the great musicians they are.
Yeah. And I think the big show things and the multi-layered and complex things, I think they become more impressive because they are so good at what you just described. And I think they do more songs of what you described, and because that really is who they are at their heart and their core. But that's what makes them amazing to me, that they can all of a sudden go bam and just knock your socks off with this other stuff. A lot of admiration for the Stones. All right, moving on.
Number six.
My number six is another one of those Keith Richards trio of guitar lines. This is the second one of our trio. And it is a superior song to Brown Sugar, I think, in every which way. It's from 1968, the album Through the Past Darkly. It hit number three in the U.S., number one in the U.K., and that is Jumpin' Jack Flash. It is named after Keith Richards' gardener. Mick and Keith were working on tunes in front of the house, and all of a sudden they got startled by a sound that was coming down the path. Mick said, "What's that?" He goes, "Oh, that's just my gardener, Jack." And so then Mick gave him the name Jack Flash, and that's what happened. It's a song that marked the band's return from their flirtations with acid and psychedelia, and kind of away from the influence of another band from England, maybe from the Liverpool area, and it got back into their mainstream of what they do best. Rolling Stone magazine called it supernatural Delta blues by the way of swinging London, and that's the beauty of the best Stones songs, drawing from multiple styles and influences in my mind. Fun note, some of the early U.S. pressings of this song on the record had a defect, which caused the song to slow down a little bit in toward the middle and before coming back up to speed. Oops, collector's edition. It is the song they have played the most often in concert. It has been played in every tour since its release. It's gritty. It moves. It's the Stones, Jumpin' Jack Flash, and I love it at number six.
Agree with everything you've said, and I'll add a little bit more to it when I mention or I talk about Jumpin' Jack Flash a little higher on my list. My number six is one of the songs you've already talked about as well, and that was Street Fighting Man. All the stuff that you talked about, it was one of their first, in fact, it was the first political song that the band recorded. Interestingly enough, the Beatles released their first overtly political song, Revolution, the same month that the Stones released Street Fighting Man as well. The reason I think I had a little higher, I loved what Keith had to say about the song, and that was, quote, "When we were completely done recording Street Fighting Man and played it back, I just smiled. It's the kind of record you love to make, and they don't come that often." So if Keith's in love with the song, that makes me fall in love with the song a little bit more as well. I also found it interesting, too, that you go back and listen to that song, and it's your traditional Stones, and you picture Keith with the electric guitar and you know, all of this energy going. This song is all acoustic. The only electric instrument on the song is the bass. It was all the recording techniques that you were talking about earlier as well. It's a great tune. It's not as high or it's higher than what you had as well, but it still isn't going to make it my top five. It's at number six, and that's Street Fighting Man.
Yep. This one, I was actually, it kind of moved all over the place. It hit three different positions for me on my list. I knew it needed to be there, but initially, I thought it was going to be number 10, easy, but it kept crawling up, and then it actually made it to number five and then went back down. So anyway, all right, moving on, getting into our top five, and
number five.
My number five is what I think is one of the classic Stone songs of all time, and it's kind of that first song that you may think about when somebody mentions the Rolling Stones, at least I think a lot of people do. It was number one. It was their first number one, replacing the Four Tops' I Can't Help Myself. And that's the 1965 song from their fourth album, Out of Our Heads, Satisfaction. Everybody knows that. Or I Can't Get No Satisfaction. And Kirk's, what are you signaling to me? Does this mean what I think it means?
I'm letting you know that we've matched not only the song, but position as well, because my number five is also I Can't Get No Satisfaction.
Nice. Well, let's talk about it together, shall we?
Let's do that.
Like I said, it was their first number one hit. It's an iconic song. This is the third of that Keith Richards trio that I was talking about, those indelible guitar lines between this, Jumpin' Jack Flash, and Brown Sugar, that I think anybody hears and you go, Stones, Keith Richards, you just know it. It's that incredibly famous guitar riff that was written by him as he was falling in and out of sleep one night, and he had a cassette player going and he fell asleep. He woke up the next morning, not remember what had happened the night before as far as his work was concerned. He saw the cassette, hit it, heard this thing. He heard these rough licks, and then he heard the guitar pick fall on the ground and the sound of him snoring. So he took that and built it and turned it into Satisfaction as we know it.
Newsweek actually called that riff, quote, five notes that shook the world. And they're absolutely right. I mean, you know, Jagger said this was the song that really made the Rolling Stones. Changes from just another band into a huge monster band. It has a very catchy title. It has that catchy guitar riff. It has a great guitar sound. And it captured the spirit of the times. I mean, that's like box, check, box, check, box, check, box, check.
Jagger's lyrics are cool on that. It paints his whole frustration with Madison Ave and the American advertising syndrome and its constant barrage on its citizens. So once again, cool song, great guitar. It's all about the music. Yet the lyrics are point on and they have something to say also.
And honestly, you know, this was kind of the beginning of the comparative, if you want to call it that, between the Beatles and the Stones. The Beatles were well on their way becoming the, you know, family favorites that maybe even mom and dad could tolerate. Mm-hmm. But this was the start of the Stones becoming dangerous and debauched, and they were outsiders and they played right into that. And I think Satisfaction was the beginning of it all.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Great song to paint a bad boy image. Really popular, the Vietnam troops. In fact, a lot of you might know it is in a featuring a great sequence from Francis Ford Coppola's film Apocalypse Now. It's just kind of that song that was big in the culture, big with the fans, and cemented their identity in rock.
And not that we need to, you know, gush over it even more. You know, Grammy Hall of Fame, 1998, National Recording Registry in the Library of Congress, 2006, Rolling Stones, number two song of all time. I mean, it's Satisfaction. I mean, it's like saying it's Babe Ruth.
Nicely said. That was good.
Thank you.
Our first complete match, identical match.
Identical match.
Well, let's move on to Mount Rushmore time, shall we? And that means
number four.
My number four to start my Mount Rushmore is, I think it's just one of the coolest Stone singles, and it's got a lot of heat in it and a lot of meaning amongst it. And it is the song Gimme Shelter from the Let It Bleed album, 1969. If the 60s was mainly about freedom of spirit and love and peace and the music that embodied all that, Gimme Shelter is known as the death rattle of that decade. It was their last big hit in the 60s, 1969. It's a song that captures sadness and the danger that was hiding underneath it all of the 60s and the foreboding taste of what might come after. So it really kind of did put this is a little scary spin on what before that was a pretty cool decade overall, I think. It was a deeply political song featuring powerhouse vocals by Mary Clayton and who sings along with Jagger. Jagger said it was a song of a very violent, rough era. Vietnam, violence of the screens, unrest in the cities. He called it kind of an end of the world song. It ranks number 38 on Rolling Stone magazine's 50 or 500 greatest songs of all time. It's power in music, power in vocals and lyrics. It makes mine number four. Could have easily been higher, but you got to rank them somewhere, right? So number four, give me shelter.
It could easily be higher, and it should be higher, and I'll be talking about it a lot later on in my list. Right. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
All right, Mr. Should Be Higher. What is your number four, though? What starts off your Mount Rushmore?
My Mount Rushmore starts with a song that you've already talked about. The song is your number six is my number four. That is Jumpin' Jack Flash. You talked a lot about the things I was going to talk about. But I do think that there was importance to this song because it was a pivotal moment for the band as they were beginning to move away from psychedelia. Songs like 19th Nervous Breakdown, She's a Rainbow, Ruby Tuesday, you know, all the stuff that Brian Jones was exploring, that psychedelic sound. And they were moving away from that and pulling it back towards that blues oriented sound that Mick and Keith really embraced. You know, if you do look at it over the years, the Stones have dabbled in disco, or they've dabbled in new wave or psychedelia or pop, number of different kinds of sounds, but they've always been anchored, rooted to this blues sound as well. And I think that's what really kind of kickstarted them in 1968, you know, in that next push that gave us so many great albums over those next 3 or 4 years. The Stones, as you mentioned, have played this song live more than any other, 1,100 times, you know, over the course of the years with the concerts. And, you know, this began to darken the Stones a little bit more, and again, start playing into that bad boy image. It's an important song. It's a Stone song through and through, and it is the first face on my Mount Rushmore, Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Nice. Great song.
Number three.
My number three. And let me just say that I think it goes safe on saying that with all of our Mount Rushmore songs, even though I had Jumpin' Jack Flash at number six, I think all of these songs, I'm going to guess we've got a couple more matches coming, they could all easily be in most rock aficionados' top 50 all-time rock songs, or at least top 100 for sure. There's some strong songs here.
Oh, yeah. And if you've had a couple of shots of bourbon, absolutely.
My number three is the 1969 song, You Can't Always Get What You Want. The final track off their final album of the 60s, written mostly by Mick Jagger. Oh, I'm getting that signal again. I think we have another identical match. Do we, Kirk?
We do, and you have won the exact match bet. We have gone over the 1.5 that I had set. Congratulations.
Woohoo! Well, let me just say a couple more things, and then you can join in here.
I will do that.
I said, written mostly by Jagger. What I love about this song is it's got a huge misdirection in it that starts off with the London Bach Choir, which is a boys choir, and a beautiful French horn piece. And it just turns into an outstanding multi-level R&B hit, which Richards called a beautiful juxtaposition, just like the 60s.
I love this song. I read somewhere where somebody categorized it as the Stones version of the end of decade song that every big band at the time came out with at that point, whether it was Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon and Garfunkel, whether it was Let It Be by the Beatles, whether it was Can't Always Get What You Want, you know, trying to put just a silver lining on a tumultuous decade, you know, for the most part. It's elegant for the Stone. It's really not reliant on a Keith hook the way most of these Stone songs are, but he does have that great solo in the middle. As you said, great melody, great orchestration, great choir. I mean, I think that choir really elevates the song.
Absolutely. It's one of the Stones' favorite songs also. It only peaked at number 42, though, which blows me away. It's another one of those things that really, but oh well.
I mean, honestly, I think it got some new life because it was used so well in the film The Big Chill.
Yes. Yes.
Over the funeral scene. I really think that kind of brought it to a new generation and reminded people just how powerful that song could be.
It did. Perfect use of that song in that movie. If you haven't seen it, everybody, that's your homework assignment. Go watch The Big Chill.
Go watch The Big Chill. I also want to give a shout out to Al Cooper. I worked with his son, Brian Cooper, at Universal for years and years and years. And Al Cooper, again, is very Zelig-like in the music industry. I mean, the guy founded Blood, Sweat, and Tears. He produced Skynyrd's first couple of albums. He played with Paul Butterfield. He obviously played with the Stones, but he was the guy that played that delicate French horn at the beginning of the song as well. And just gave it that extra little touch. So Brian, if you're listening, your dad did good.
Did he play it delicately?
He played it perfectly. Smart ass.
Yep. That's me. All right. We had another exacto. Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. That brings us to
number two.
My number two was also a number one hit. It was from the UK album called Big Hits and the US album called Aftermath in 1966. And that is Paint It Black. This is the ultimate display of a song that I couldn't have cared less about when I was young, when I was in my preteens hearing the Stones for the first time. It was all about Satisfaction and Jumpin' Jack Flash and those kind of songs. But the more I heard the song, the more I loved it, and the more it's just ingrained in who I am as a Stones fan now. It's the Stones' overall strength, I believe, lies in their connection with their bass and their honest connection with their audience. It and Painted Black highlights this connection. It dabbles in Eastern influences of music while keeping Keith's guitar and Charlie Watts' drums very much in the front and center. And the fans eat it up. It's just the real big Stones fans, I think, just hold this in very high esteem. Richards claims they wrote it as a comedy track, which blew me away when I researched that. I had no clue. What came, what it exists now is a frightening portrayal of death and grief and sex. And it's portrayed with lyrics like, I see the girls walk by dressed in their summer clothes. I have to turn my head until my darkness goes. Dark stuff there. Bill Wyman's rolling bass line is credited for pushing the song by the other band members, pushing the song in the right direction during the recording. He wrote it on a Hammond organ, which I guess he was he tended to do sometimes. The sound the band generates is psychedelic, yet it's still disturbing and dark. Richards thought it was a different style to everything I'd done before, and he was right. It's amazing. It's a masterpiece, I think. It's my number two.
And it is a song that I have not included on my list.
Oh, really?
That is one of the songs that did not make it. Again, you know, all the ones that we haven't matched on are easily my unlisted list. So I'm going to have to come up with a few more for that at the end of the show. But, you know, it's another one of those, okay, I put it on. What song do I take off?
Yeah.
And I just couldn't find that fit of, you know, when I looked at that list, it's like, I just don't see where it can go. I've never been a big fan of that sitar sound either. So that probably pushed it out of my top 10 for me as well. It is a great song. It's a groundbreaking song. It's not one of my favorite Stone songs, and I don't think it's one of their 10 best.
Yeah, I got to say, it's my favorite use of the sitar outside of maybe a couple of things that George Harrison did. It's usually one of those nails on a chalkboard type thing. I think it's so cool in this song. Wow. See, when you didn't have it on the bottom of your list, I just assumed it was going to be up high. Interesting. Okay, now I'm all ears. What's your number two?
My number two is from the album Beggar's Banquet, 1968. This is one of those songs that again, really solidified the bad boy image for the Stones. And it is, of course, Sympathy for the Devil.
What?
Interestingly enough,
I'm kidding.
Yeah. You know, Keith said that the song was originally a Dylan-esque turgid folk song that, you know, they worked on and came up with this rocking kind of samba line to it. You know, you hear the congas, you hear the maracas, you hear the unique instruments in there. And as he said, it went from a turkey to a hit just on the shift of rhythm. It's a hypnotic song. It's a seductive song. The piano is the hook this time around. And honestly, I think this really did, if it didn't change, it solidified the way the public looked at the Rolling Stones. They saw them as the bad boy to the Beatles' good boys. Sympathy was the most pointed record they had written to this point in time. They may have danced around some things and innuendo along the way. This is the first time they stood up and really took that chance, took the position. Douglas Cruikshank stated that this was at the very pinnacle of the flower power era, remember, and the devil, in this case, Mick, turns on his starry-eyed audience and tells them that they, in league with him, are to blame for the deaths of the 60s most promising political leaders. Whoa. I mean, that's a far step away from goodbye Ruby Tuesday. I mean, that was a huge step forward for the Stones. It really began to cast them in that outsider bad boy role, which they relished. So not only was it a great song, it was important for the Stones as well. So Sympathy for the Devil is my number two.
Inspired choice for you, young Padawan.
Let's move on.
Number one.
My number one is, surprise, surprise, Sympathy for the Devil. to me, there's some similarities with you can't always get what you want. It's that whole complete misdirection. Starts off on one thing and becomes something else. And I love it. And this one is even better than you can't always get what you want. You mentioned a lot of the things, so I'm not going to talk too much about it, except I do love the fact that when the song was released, it's called Sympathy for the Devil. When it was released, literally all hell did break loose, as it was the first rock song sung in the first person of the devil. And a band got labeled devil worshippers by critics. Mick Jagger wrote both the lyrics and music. And then sometimes they'd play into that paranoia. Sometimes they wouldn't. Sometimes they did. No, we're not Satan worshippers and everything. Well, the song speaks for itself. You know, it depended what day you got them on what they were answering. And that's another thing that I love about both the Beatles and the Stones, how they would manipulate and play with the media. It was one of the most difficult songs for the band to find in the studio, according to them. But find it they did. The TV debut of the single was on the Rock and Roll Circus concert film, and it was founder Brian Jones' last TV appearance before his death. In concert, though, if you've ever seen this song, in concert, you can tell how much Mick Jagger loves to perform this song, much like when he does Give Me Shelter and Satisfaction, a couple of others, Jumpin' Jack Flash. He just eats this one alive on stage. It's a masterclass of composition and a performance. It's a classic, and it's why it's my number one. And you're number two.
Yeah, they have ridden this song for 50 years.
Absolutely.
And there's not a lot of bands, mainstream bands, that could have gotten away with it, quite honestly. And it's to their credit that it really solidified them and propelled them rather than hindered them.
Yeah, and it's gone way past the lyrics now, at least when you see it in concert. It's just become that one of those Stone songs that you got to see, and you want them to perform it. And when they do, very late in the show, it's awesome. All right, that means we have one song left, and that's your number one. What is it, Mr. Trudner?
The last face on my Mount Rushmore is a song that you've already talked about. It was your number four. It's my number one. That is from the Let It Bleed album in 1969, Gimme Shelter. Ah. There has never been a time that this song has not been relevant. It speaks to each generation seeking shelter from their own storms. This is where I'm going to veer off from you a little bit. While I agree, you know, this was a song about violence and the turbulent times, et cetera. Some of the stuff I read really kind of painted this as the song that said, all this stuff's going on, I just need shelter from it. And I think that's what applies to each generation moving ahead. So whether it's the generation that's going through the AIDS pandemic, whether it's the generation that survived 9/11, whether it's a generation that's going through, you know, COVID now, we've all had these storms we've wanted shelter from. And that's where I think this song still is relevant to a lot of listeners. It's one of the greatest album opening tracks of all time. And it is truly one of those rare songs that typifies, that personifies a band. You mentioned Mary Clayton, the vocal that she put in, that great female vocal, awesome. Still the most prominent contribution to a Rolling Stones track that a female vocalist provided. My favorite little kind of a side story on this was Keith Richards saying that the Australian made Maton, SE-777, a large single cutaway hollow body guitar, barely survived the recording before falling apart. Quote, on the last note of Gimme Shelter, the whole neck fell off. You can hear it in the original take. It just dropped off. You know, that's kind of the way of saying
Pete Townsend itself.
Yeah, you know, you can't do any better than this. So for all the reasons above, it's an interesting song. It's a hypnotic, powerful, draw you in kind of song. It builds, it pays off. It's just a great tune. So Gimme Shelter is my number one and my fourth face on Mount Rushmore.
Nice, very worthy choice. Good list there, brother. Good list.
You too. Again, you know, throw a dart. You're not going to hit a bad song.
Yeah, it's embarrassing and riches. Okay, so let's get to the unlisted, the sequel segment before we take a little break here. And we already mentioned a lot of songs that made my list but didn't make yours and vice versa, so we won't talk about those. Give me three or four other honorable mentions. For me personally, Angie is up there, another one of the slow songs, the love songs that I do like a lot. But Under My Thumb, Miss You, I love Miss You a lot. And then the one that almost made my list, that just killed me not to have on there was Start Me Up, which I give it credit for relaunching the band back into what they did best in the 80s. And it was their biggest hit of the 80s from 1981, I believe, from the Tattoo You. Is that right? Yeah, Tattoo You album. So those are mine. Yeah. What about you?
All the ones that you just mentioned. I would also include, I mean, as I looked over my list and I'm reviewing it again now, I realized most of my stuff is from like 67 to 73, which is, you know, easily the meat and potatoes of what the Stones recorded. You know, that really creative time. I think Beast of Burden is a great tune. I think Shattered is a wonderful underrated Stones tune. From Tattoo You, I love Waiting on a Friend. You know, another one of those great slow songs that they just found the right place to be, the right elegance for that number. I just think it's terrific. And then even Mixed Emotions off of the Steel Wheels album in the 90s, you know, is a good tune as well. Mm-hmm. Not top 10, obviously, but still great songs.
All right, good stuff. We're going to take a small break and we will be back with the guest list. And we are back. We're having fun talking best Stone songs. And to continue, it must be time for
the guest list.
You know, joining us tonight on the guest list is a guy who's been a good friend of mine for about 15 years. He's one of the most respected musicians and drummers in Nashville and the recording industry as a whole. I mean, this guy has recorded or played with over 100 major acts, Kenny Loggins, Jamie Johnson, Luke Bryan. When the band Alabama reunited in 2012, he joined them as their drummer for more than 350 shows and the live CD, DVD, Alabama and Friends at the Ryman Auditorium. Speaking of the Ryman, just last night, he played a 4-hour show, the Steve Cropper's 80th birthday, with Billy Gibbons from ZZ Top. He's also a member of the band Six Wire, which was featured on the ABC series Nashville as the backup band for the character of Raina James, played by Connie Britton. Six Wire has also been the featured entertainment at a number of events. The 2019 NFL Draft, the Academy of Country Music Awards All-Star Jam Post Show, Alice Cooper's annual charity event. The list goes on and on. But I think my favorite band that he plays in is a little group called the Small Time Rockstars that are the house band for the Nashville Predators of the NHL. He is a terrific musician, unbelievable drummer, terrific friend. So please welcome to the show, Chuck Tilley.
How you doing, hey, Chuck?
Thank you, Kirk. I'm doing great. I'm so glad to join you guys today.
So, Chuck, we're here for our season 2 premiere talking best Rolling Stones songs. And that's a lot of material that was made during a lot of years, a lot of great songs. How do you, Chuck Tilley, sort through all that stuff to make your list? Was it mind-boggling? How did you do it?
It's hard. It's hard to approach. In that they have almost 60 years of a recording career. And when Kirk asked me about doing this episode, I said, sure. I can think of 10 songs off the top of my head. And then I started really thinking about it and looking at my albums. And I looked at the numbers and it said, you know, they have 30 studio albums and 33 live albums and then 121 singles over all these years. And then I realized there's no way it would be so hard to narrow it down to 10. It seems like my 10 are songs that, you know, something that most everybody knows and are familiar with, but it was absolutely overwhelming. The only comparison I can make would be the Beatles, but you know, as we know, the Beatles' recording career was really not that long, maybe 10 years tops. And we have almost 60 years to choose from the Stones. And so it's a lot of music.
Absolutely.
It is.
Definitely.
when we had Pat Bouts on, our good friend Pat Bouts, to end last year and do the Beatles top 10, the point of view he brought to it was production. He looked at some of the songs and gave a little bit more weight to production. Did you do something like this as a drummer and look at it maybe from the point of view of the late, great Charlie Watts?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, and that was another thing. Well, all of it was so fresh on my mind because, every serious drummer I know just loves Charlie and loves his approach and just how creative he was. And so, yeah, a lot of it was fresh on my mind. And I did come at some of it from the angle of a drummer, but I did try to put it in different categories of kind of the 60s, 70s stuff, and then maybe the early 80s stuff. And then it's just all over the map. When you have a straight ahead, bluesy rock song like Honky Tonk Women, and then you compare that to Symphony for the Devil, and you think, is this the same band? You know, I mean, there's so many different things in play, musically speaking. And so I kind of went at it from that approach of just as a musician and just as, okay, here's some different eras, here's some different production methods, here's some different musical instruments that they brought into, the recording. It's such a wide range of approaches that they took. So I tried to take that approach as well, but it's still, I just can't get over how overwhelming their catalog is. I mean, I'll do my best, but
Well, now we're very intrigued to hear your list. So let's get into it. Chuck Tilley, who are your number 10 through number 8 picks?
Well, and a lot of these I took from the context of what I've gone on at the time that the song recorded. So I'm coming out of left field. My number 10 was the song Miss You. You know, it was around 1978. I know it's on the Some Girls album. If you remember musically what's going on at the time, disco was still going on. Might have been at its peak, probably on the way out, but there was still a lot of disco stuff on the radio, and you had rock bands and other people trying to adjust and even musically kind of go that direction with the four on the floor and the kind of the bass line. So you take a song like Miss You, and here you've got a bluesy rock band doing this almost disco bass line, but it's just a cool song. I know everybody sings along to it. You think that line, what is it? Come up here with a case of wine. All these Puerto Rican girls are just dying to meet you. all that. I mean, there's so many, memorable hooks in that. But anyway, number 10, it was so different than anything else they had done. And so I picked Miss You as my number 10.
All right.
Good choice.
Number 9?
Number 9. All right. I'm going another different direction. I liked the song It's Only Rock and Roll song that starts out with just a guitar riff and then the band kind of falls in. And that's just kind of a signature that they do. If you know a lot of the straight ahead rock songs, not the big production numbers, obviously, but there's so many of the songs, it's Keith just starting a riff, for two bars, maybe four bars, and then the drums and the rest of the band just kind of fall in, which is totally the way they do it live, then later on the horns come in and all that stuff. But I just thought, okay, here's a raw rock band. They've got a great memorable chorus. It's only rock and roll, but I like it. It's like, don't take everything so seriously. And it's just another memorable, it's the Stones as soon as you hear it.
Well, I'm 0-2 with you. I missed on both of those songs. So what's your number 8 so I can maybe try and get caught up?
Number 8, I chose Honky Tonk Women.
Yes, love it.
And for similar reasons. And I know that was around 1969, 1970. But what other song can you name that the cowbell starts? You hear the first four bars and it's the Stones.
True.
And it's this dinky little cheap small cowbell about the size of a deck of cards. It's not even a real big one. It's a little girly cowbell. And I didn't know. I always assumed Charlie played it and then went into the drum thing, but he didn't. The producer, Jimmy Milner, played the cowbell, and then Charlie comes in. So it wasn't Charlie playing it. I always assumed it was, but I had to read up on it because, like, I always loved the song. And it's just one of those, there again, just one of these cool riffs and great drum groove, and everybody knows it. Everybody sings along. Every cover band I've ever been in my whole life, you play Honky Tonk Women. You know, and it's just one of those recognizable, cool songs. It's nothing really serious about it, you know. So that was my number eight.
Well, you described it great when you said what your criteria was and how you didn't want to go for deep cuts, but you're also not really going for the most obvious stuff. These are great songs. You know, these are that would be on most everybody's list. I missed on all three. Steve got one of them.
Yeah, I did.
I'll tell you what, why don't you give us seven, well, give us five through seven, and then we'll talk about those.
Okay. Number seven, I picked Paint It Black.
Excellent.
There again, it was the, at the time it was cut, what was going on musically, it has that Middle Eastern, the percussion, the sitar type, well, the sitar that was used, and then the sitar like sounding guitars they used. The melody, it just had this Middle Eastern influence, and it was just very different than what they had done really before and after. But and me as a drummer, of course, all the driving tom, you know, the tom-tom just pulsating throughout the whole thing, and all this hand percussion and all these things going on, it was really driven by the percussion and the toms as opposed to the standard drum set, you know. So I just thought it was, man, it's something different. So I choose it. I put it at number seven. Number six, jumping back to the 80s, I picked Start Me Up.
Thank you.
You know, off the 1981 Tattoo You album. I have the vinyl. Another iconic guitar intro, and you still hear the song at sporting events. You hear it all over the place in different uses. There again, as a drummer, when Charlie comes in, just that groove is just powerful groove. Everything about Keith's guitar, the tone, the way he played it, it's just one of those recognizable, just great rocking track. The vocal, the choruses, it's just, you know, it's one of those songs that you hear it on the radio every day. If you listen to classic rock radio and whatnot, I mean, I know the song's 40 years old, but you know, you hear it all the time. And anyway, I gave it number six. It probably could have went higher on my own, but there's so many great ones to get to. I had to make the top 10 because that's just one of my favorite out of that era of the late 70s, early 80s. That was one of my favorites.
Number five.
Okay. Another different one. I think my top 10 was a lot of different songs that were just unique, is the word I'm trying to say. I chose You Can't Always Get What You Want.
I finally matched Chuck.
Oh, jeez.
Really? Yeah. Number five? Really? Wow. And the reason was, I mean, my gosh, there's so many elements going on. The huge production. You've got, I mean, just the hook line itself. You know, okay, it might be kind of cliche, but it still rings true. It's one of those simple truths in life, you know, the hook, the lyric. But you've got the orchestra, full orchestra, boys choir or a youth choir, a London youth choir, the massive production. Again, when you hear it, you know immediately it's the Stones. And then it just, there's so much stuff. And I know that it to me, it maybe had some Beatles influence or whatnot, but it's just a lot when you think, okay, is this the same band that did Tumbling Dice or Honky Tonk Women? Is that the same band, you know? And so so I gave it number five.
Well, we both loved it for its originality and had it as both of our number threes on our list, coincidentally.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I tell you, once to me, I had a real struggle with picking a top five or six because there's just so many. And I think you could almost shuffle the order of any of the top three. You know, it's just it's a tough chore. We'll finish this interview and I'll probably wake up at 3 a.m. and go, why didn't I pick this song? How could I forget this song? And I'm sure people listening to this are going, why is that knucklehead not naming this song? You know, like he left off these other 10 great songs. What's wrong with this guy? You know, so I'm sure people will question my top 10, but it's like, there's just too many great ones to pick.
Welcome to our world. Well, the thing we always tell people, because, you know, that's the thing we love about the show and the feedback we've gotten, is it does start conversations.
Oh, it does.
You know, you give a 10 and they go, why didn't you put on such and such? And my response is, great. What song do you take off? You know, that's the hard part.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's totally that. How can you justify that song and kick this one off? It's like, yeah. So it's, I sat down and just started writing notes. I came up with, you know, 25 songs or so off the top of my head. And then I started looking at albums going, oh my gosh, there's all these other ones that I still know these two. And so I narrowed it down to like 20, and then I tried to cut it down to 10. And even I just made little notes about each song off the top of my head and just little background knowledge that I knew.
Yeah.
And then I can remember interviews I read that Charlie did or Keith did or whoever. And I would remember little stories that they said or where they recorded or how they wrote it or what it was about or whatever. So I would just made a few notes, you know, off just from memory of reading years of interviews and whatnot. And of course, now with Charlie just passing away recently, there's, you know, Charlie and the Stones are all over the media now. So you can hear things on the radio or the internet all the time. You know, now here it is, first week of September, and he passed away, you know, a few weeks ago. And so it's still all over the news. And so there's been a lot of great videos and interviews. So I've kind of been looking at some of that stuff recently and going, oh, yeah, I remember that. Or just, you know, I can remember old interviews that they did. And so that's how some of this information I got, just from remembering interviews that I heard them do.
Hey,
you
know, Chuck.
Years ago.
Chuck, mm-hmm. Before we get to your Mount Rushmore, your top four, let me ask you a question. Is it possible that the drummer for the Rolling Stones, 50-year career, all the songs we've talked about, is it possible that even after all that, he was still very underrated?
Yeah, I think so. Not by the really serious drummers who have studied him and really paid attention to his career. Yes, absolutely. I think he's underrated, because especially in this day and age, when you can go on the internet and you can see this eighth grade kid blowing chops and playing these machine gun licks and have a big double bass drum set with, you know, 10 tom toms and 20 cymbals. And, you know, you can see stuff like that. And here you got Charlie with this little four piece drum set, very small jazz drum set, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's just laying it down, playing these cool grooves. And I think there might be a whole lot of people who don't appreciate how brilliant he was and how strong his groove is. And I know younger drummers, especially, and even myself, when I was, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s coming up, and as a younger guy, yeah, I was learning this Stone stuff and I was going, well, I can play the notes, but it doesn't feel right. I don't have the right feel. I'm not locking in with what Keith's guitar is doing. And so that's when I started appreciating it as a teenager or even younger, going back and trying to get the right feel and have the soul and that kind of a swing he has on certain things, you know. Same with Ringo. I think Ringo and Charlie are both very underrated. But yes, in this day and age, can Charlie be underrated? Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the more you study him, though, as a drummer and even just as other musicians, they can appreciate the strong grooves and how he played the right part. He played what was right for the song. He played off of Keith's guitar riff, because most of the songs, you know, Keith wrote the music, wrote the guitar part, and Charlie just jumped on and played whatever that song needed. And he never overplayed, but he would do these tasty, cool little fills and licks and just little things. It's like, oh my God, what was that? Rewind. I got to go back and listen to that. What did he just do? You know? Like you hear a real fast up-tempo thing like Shattered, and he's kind of weaving in and out and bobbing and weaving and doing all these cool little things, playing off the guitar. And this is not something you would do 100 takes of. You know, you do a handful of takes. It's very, very spontaneous, very ad-lib. And they came up with some brilliant stuff. So that was, I think that was part of his genius, was that he would just would play off of whatever Keith was doing and just make it work. And he never overplayed, and just very tasteful, efficient drumming. You know, he never overdid it, you know, and just there's an art to that. And it's hard.
There is.
That is such great insight.
Well said.
That is wonderful. All right. Speaking of genius. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, well, all right. Well, like I say, I'm all over the map with this. My number four was Brown Sugar. And I chose it because I knew it was recorded in, I think, 69, maybe 70. I think it came out in 70 or 71. But it was just different than what everybody else was doing at that time. I liked it personally because they recorded it in Muscle Shoals. And there was all this, if you know the history of Muscle Shoals, Alabama recording, it was a law. At that time, it was, you know, a lot of R&B, blues, and soul stuff. You know, Aretha had recorded there, and Otis Redding and different people. Earlier, you know, Bobby Gentry. But it was known as a, you know, R&B, soul, bluesy type vibe there. And for the Stones, I know they were on tour, and they snuck in there, and it was real hush hush. I'm from Alabama, and so that was a real point of pride, and we just, everybody thought it was great that, hey man, here's one of the biggest rock bands in the world coming in to, you know, record in this very little small town in northern Alabama that had been previously known for, you know, a bunch of other type music, and here you got a British rock band coming in, you know, like, you know, so it was just kind of a nice feather in the cap for Muscle Shoals. And I always liked the song. There again, it's one of those songs that cover bands still play to this day, and you hear it on the radio, and you know, so that was my thought for number four.
Good one. What's your number three?
All right, so number three, I'm going way back, the mid 60s. I picked number three. I picked Satisfaction.
Nice.
Because for a lot of reasons, but I thought it was probably the most important song of their career because it was their first number one. And when you have a number one that massive, then that gives you access and more leverage and power to do a whole lot of other things you want to do, you know, whether it be recording or touring or whatever. I think that was a big launching point for them at that time, you know, so immediately identifiable, that driving guitar opening riff and that distorted had a real unique tone to it. And then Charlie comes in and it's just pulsating like a, you know, just like a steel hammer throughout the whole song, just driving it the whole way through. And, it, you know, it was their first number one. So I think my humble opinion is that should probably be in everybody's top three just because of the importance of the song and what it did for their career.
Good call. So you have two songs that top it. What's your number two?
All right, number two. I chose Sympathy for the Devil because, like many of my top 10 picks, it was different than anything else they had done. It's very piano dominated. Just the piano playing all these block chords, as opposed to usually opening with a big guitar riff and being very guitar dominant. I mean, yes, there's guitar on it, but it's very piano dominated, which was a different thing for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there's all this percussion and an iconic conga track. The conga part is fantastic. You know, a lot of percussion going on. The bass line, to me, the bass is just driving it. It's the bass is driving it throughout the whole song. The bass is just, it's just propelling the whole track. You know, the whole time. And while the piano is just playing,
that's going to be our new lead into the show, by the way.
Yeah, sample that. You know, with the piano just playing these block chords, and I'm not trying to get too deep in the weeds with, you know, with the music production stuff and all that, but it was just different than anything they had done, and that's why I thought it was unique and deserved to be in the top 10 and really my, you know, top two really, and then. Which leads to number one, I guess.
You have two guys who agree with you. Kirk had Sympathy as his number two, and I had it as number one. So, oh, yeah, wow. We're in agreement.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I love that song. I, you know, part of the fun of doing this show, and Steve and I have talked about this, is the research you get to do. And I had no idea that that was a samba beat.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. You know? Yeah. It is a Latin, very Latin influence. And there's a ton of percussion on there. And of course that conga track just drives it. You know, that's a conga drum. But the bass line is even kind of a Latin feel, you know, it's just, there is a lot of Latin influence on it for sure.
There's a lot going into that song. That's what makes it so great.
Yeah. It's there again. I keep repeating myself, but it's like when you hear a song like that and Paint It Black and you go, wow, this is the same band that did Tumbling Dice and did Honky Tonk Women. And it's just amazing how they can be all over the map musically and production wise. And it's still the same band. You know, that's what as a musician, that's what has always impressed me with them. And then later, of course, they evolve and they, you know, all the stuff they did in the '70s and late '70s and early '80s, they just kept evolving and kept reinventing themselves. Really, you know, it's amazing.
All right, Chuck. So at number 10, you had Miss You. Number 9, Only Rock and Roll. 8 was Honky Tonk Women.
Yeah.
Paint It Black. Start Me Up. You Can't Always Get What You Want, Brown Sugar, Satisfaction, Sympathy for the Devil. What is your number one Rolling Stones song?
I'm going with Gimme Shelter.
Good choice.
And I'm sure a lot of other people have as well. But, I mean, that was that 1969, Let It Bleed, I think it was. And I, you know, it's I'm sure a lot of other people picked that as number one or two. But you think of what was going on in the world at that time in 68, 69, 70, just everything that was going on in the world at the time, you know, besides the Vietnam War and just everything going on at home. It's one of those timeless songs.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure if it was ever released as a single. I know it eventually became a single, but I don't know if it was officially released as one, but just the fact that it's been in so many movie soundtracks. I know, at least how many Scorsese films has it been in? Kirk probably knows. I know at least two.
Three of them. Goodfellas, Casino, and The Departed. Yeah.
Okay. I knew Casino and Goodfellas. Gosh. Okay. Wow. So three.
Yeah.
And among others and other uses. I mean, you're talking about getting a lot of use out of a song, but
absolutely,
you know, it's just the theme, the whole, I don't know. It's some people are like, oh, it's depressing. It's into the world and, you know, apocalyptic and all that. And okay. Yeah. But you put it in context of when it was written, what was going on in the world. You know, I mean, there was probably several mini songs with that kind of theme, you know, at that time.
You know, Chuck, it's interesting because the first 9 songs you talked about, we went right to the musicality. And I find it interesting that with Gimme Shelter, and I think all of us had that same impression, the first thing we went to was the time it reflected.
I didn't even think about that, but you're right. The lyrics, it's just a powerful song. And of course, I know the lady, is it Mary Clayton?
Clayton,
that's it. Yeah, Mary Clayton. You know, when she comes in with her lyric at the end, you know, rape, murder, it's just a shot. I mean, my gosh, what a powerful performance. It just is incredible. I think I read she did it in maybe 2 takes, no
two
more
takes,
than 3
yeah.
takes. Yeah,
yeah.
2 or 3 takes. I think she was pregnant and was sitting down or something. Charlie talked about it in one of his interviews that I had read. Because I didn't know the background. I didn't know her name. I didn't know anything about her, you know. And
I mean, the story that I understood was the producer literally called her at like 12:30 at night. And she came down to the studio in like bathrobe and curlers.
Oh, my gosh.
And did one take. And then she said, can I have one more?
Hmm.
And did the second one. And when her voice cracks on Murder, you can hear Mick on the track going, woo.
Yeah.
Great.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow. Well, I tell you, I've been lucky enough to see them live a few times, and man, when they do that song live, it's they've got some incredible background singers, and it's a big production number. And I'm sure you guys have seen them live, but it is powerful. It is a really powerful piece of music, and you got people, a stadium full of people singing along. You know, it's just a shadow, you know, and all that. I mean, it's it's a pretty powerful moment in their show. And
to me, it's a song that just epitomizes the Stones.
Well, yeah, it does. There's a lot of contenders, but I just thought, all right, I've got to put that one number one. I couldn't justify ranking another one above that one.
It's a great
I would
list.
Agree. That's a great list, Chuck.
So, Chuck, if somebody wanted to follow you, how would they do it?
Well, yeah, I'm at Chuck D. Tilly on Facebook, and then I think Chuck Tilly Drums on Instagram and all that. And most of it is just my musical adventures with me and my band Six Wire, and we're always doing these multi-artist shows for a lot of different rock stars and whatnot, and some country stars as well. And Six Wire is the band, sixwire.com, and then we do a lot of big charity music events for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. We do a lot of big events all over the country.
Nice.
All during the year for St. Jude. So that's kind of our source of pride there, that we get to be involved with them. And we have been, and one little plug, our band Six Wire we've done these big music events for St. Jude now for over 10 years, and they have in total raised more than $24 million.
Good for you.
These events have for these celebrity charity events. And most of them are, the biggest one is called the Warburton, the Patrick Warburton event in Palm Desert every March. We have about 10, maybe 10 or 12 rock stars donate their time. And we come and put on a 3 or 4 hour show, and everybody sings 3 or 4 of their number one big, huge hits. We'll have Alice Cooper or Kevin Cronin from REO Speedwagon, or Huey Lewis, or Don Felder from the Eagles, or, I got a whole long list of rock stars. But these events have 10 or 12 rock stars. They all donate their time, and they come and sing a bunch of their hits, and it's a big, long show. People pay good money to see these shows. And anyway, we've been doing it for over 10 years, and we raise money for St. Jude. So that's one of our main events that we do as a band, Six Wire.
That is such good stuff, Chuck. I can't wait to see one of those shows one of these days.
Well, I will warn you next time. Well, we'll be in Palm Desert March for the Patrick Warburton event. But we've got an event in November in Naples, Florida, and we got some other ones. But they're all over the country now. We do them just everywhere at this point.
So, guys, look up these St. Jude events and check it out.
Well, Chuck, I know you're so busy. Thank you for your time.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, you're very welcome, guys. It was my pleasure, and it was really fun to sit down and really think about this music and really listen to some of it. And it just was fun for me to revisit all of this stuff anyway. So it was my pleasure, guys.
Hope to see you again soon. Thanks, Chuck.
You're very welcome, man. I'll warn you when I'm out your way next time.
Please do. Stay safe, Chuck. Take care, brother.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Great guy. Wealth of knowledge there.
Oh, like I said, I've known Chuck for about 15 years. We met at the Tim Wakefield golf tournament. Our good friend D. Vincent Williams brought him down, and he's just the salt of the earth. We've had a number of adventures at theme parks together.
Yeah. Yeah. Dude, we have to find out a way to score tickets for that event when he's here.
I think so. The super what?
That's pretty cool. All right. Well, that brings us to our next segment where we hear from you listeners. It's the listeners poll results, and that means it is
the Populist.
And on the Populist today, we had a few ties like we do. So you know what? Unlike last year where I just filled every spot and read every tie, we had all these things, I'm going to honor the ties like they do in a real poll. So because we had a tie for number 9, that means there is no number.
Take a stance. Yeah. Be that guy.
We have no number 10, damn it, because we had a tie for 9, and it was a 4-way tie, and that included Wild Horses, Start Me Up, yay, Angie, and It's Only Rock and Roll. There's nothing, no 8 for you, because we have a 2-way tie for number 7, which is Honky Tonk Woman and Jumpin' Jack Flash. No number 6, because there's a 2-way tie for number 5, at Brown Sugar and Paint It Black. All Alone at number 4 was Sympathy for the Devil. All Alone at number 3 was Gimme Shelter. No 2 for you either, because there was a 2-way tie for our top spot at number 1, and those are Satisfaction and You Can't Always Get What You Want. Pretty good.
Make up your mind.
Yeah. Pretty good couple number ones there, though, if I do say it myself. Good job, listeners. Keep voting. The more the merrier, the more the vote, the less ties there will be, obviously. And we like hearing what you have to think. Well, dude, that about does it for us on the inaugural episode of season two, in parentheses, take two.
Welcome back.
Yeah, right. Glad we got it done this time. Get rid of them gremlins. It's so nice to be back. It was great talking about the stones and looking forward to the topics we have coming up this year. And we do have a lot of great topics coming your way, everybody, including two mega months. But more about those. We changed the format a little bit later. So don't worry. It won't be 4 weeks of college football. And we'll be talking about teeth.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
In fact, the fight song episode was actually fairly popular. So it wasn't a total train wreck.
That's the spirit.
We'll be talking about TV, sports, movies, food, travel, more music, and we're excited to get into all of that. But next week, as we start heading into the baseball playoffs, we're going to discuss best baseball players of all time. So that's a pretty big group. That's a pretty wide thing, and we're going to try to figure out position players and pitchers and how do they both fit onto that list, two distinctly different disciplines. Off the top of your head, do you have three or four?
And how many different eras are we talking about,
too? I know, right?
Are we talking about the amphetamine era? Are we talking about the steroid era? Are we talking about the...
We're talking about all time. But I don't know about you, but for me, I tend to go back to the roots a little bit more. You know, things that came first gave way to new things and set the standard. So if I had to say off the top of my head, guys like Babe Ruth are probably going to be on my list. Maybe, Joe DiMaggio, Willie Mays. What about you?
Yeah, I tend to go back to, you know, maybe even earlier, Ty Cobb, Walter Johnson, Christy Mathewson, Mel Ott.
Wow.
I want to give credit where credit is due to Major League Baseball, that now that they're including the Negro League records in the overall baseball, professional baseball records. Good point.
Yeah.
You know, that opens up a whole, you know, cool Papa Bell. You know, there's a lot of people we can look at here. So this is when I always love doing research, but this is when I'm really going to enjoy rolling up my sleeves. You know, I was making fun of the steroid era and the amphetamine era, but at a certain point, you know, you can only play who's in front of you, mm-hmm. as the old saying goes. Mm-hmm. So, were those who were using steroids, an advantage? Were those who were doing amphetamines an advantage? You know, all of those different things. So I'm just looking at it as a complete clean slate. That is my hint at my criteria right now.
Ooh, will we see a Barry Bonds or a Roger Clemens on Kirk's list? Interesting.
Maybe.
Tune in 2 weeks, everybody, and find out, because that's what we'll be discussing here. All right. As always, please go to the website just to check it out and see what's up with the show, but especially to vote on that listener's poll, and that's at populouspodcast.net. Go vote early, vote often. We want to hear what you think.
And you can find Populist at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, Google, iHeartRadio, Pandora, or wherever you go to get your quality podcasts. We are a member of the Buzzsprout community, and Populist is a Vintage Year production.
Yes, we are. If you want to find us on Facebook, facebook.com/populouspodcast would be the place. And on Twitter at populist_pod. We are trying to stay active on those things, and you can see what's coming up, what listener poll is happening, and all those sort of fun things. All right, dude. Nice show. Great to be with you.
Welcome back. Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for joining us. It's going to be a great season. Stick around. It's going to be a lot of laughs, a lot of fun, and a lot of arguments.
We'll catch you all in about 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
Stay safe, everyone.